Have you looked into, didn't you say, Floyd, you'd looked into some of John Pauline and had sat in some of his classes years ago, right? Have you read some of his stuff on Revelation?
He, I actually went to his class at the seminary on Revelation.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. I couldn't remember if it was on.
Yeah, it was probably 30, 35 years ago.
Because my friend, who's one of the members of this study, she says that she thinks it would really be good. I've been telling her about Siegfried Tonstadt. She says maybe between those two, we could, have some scholars help us as we plod into this, plod into the read and read the book.
I would strongly suggest, I mean, it's great for resources, but when I started studying this, I decided to try to just let the word be the primary source
Okay.
initially and see what came out. And there were so many people feel like, well, I'm not smart enough. Wait a minute. We don't believe that God actually wants to talk to us directly. He wants to teach us directly. That doesn't mean we don't listen to anybody else. It doesn't mean we don't ask questions, but I think he wants to get the first crack at it.
I agree. Good point.
And then people's self-worth begins growing when they realize, it's not about figuring out the right answer, because that's a pitfall in itself. It's like, what might God say to me
Exactly.
out of this?
That's right. Right.
And that's when I've gone into this. And
Yeah, I like that.
one of the things that really helped was, and I quickly weaned off looking for the right answer when I realized there are many right answers. They might contradict each other. Some of them are less right than other ones, but I don't have to obsess over figuring out the one and only right answer, like I thought most of my life. And when I took that wall away, but I'm still, what I'm doing is I'm looking for the best answer, not the right answer. And when several of them weigh in pretty heavy, I leave them all on the table and just keep sifting through. And after a while, it's like, okay, this one's nice, but I like this one better because it synchronizes with everything else better. And that freedom to make mistakes or to whatever, but there's no condemnation and no reproach, as James says. He's generous and he's without reproach. That's really important.
And of course, Revelation 1:3 says, a joyous blessing rests upon the one who reads this message, upon those who hear and embrace the words of prophecy. So you go, okay, there's a blessing here. There's something here for I want to approach it very personally because growing up, Revelation seminars, they were not personal at all. It was all about history, going to take place, and a very penal legal view, particularly as you got into the investigation, with the emphasis on are all your sins confessed, because got to get those all confessed or God's going to punish you. So I want a very different, which is, of course, breaks Jesus's heart. But it needs to be personal, applicable, and the Spirit's got to be the one to lead us. And it's going to be different emphasis for different people, but still something that can be applicable. Real life stuff. It's supposed to show up in real life. Yes. Threads and themes. I like the title because I think I really appreciated you talking about themes because I was raised with here's the scripture here. Oh, and then here's another one over here. And there was not, you're focused on trees. It was all text and here a little, there a little, not going, oh, what is this book? What's the theme of this book? How does this theme, and you know, how does this relate to this theme here? Wasn't so I have a
Well,
hard time seeing. It's really looking for the big idea.
and you know about that here and there a little, right?
Say more.
Which means you end up with nothing. Hear a little. No, tell me the rest. There's a funny, right, in that. Hear a little there, a
No,
little.
it's serious. It's very serious. It's in Isaiah 26, maybe, and I finally decided to go investigate it for myself. I found out years ago, God keeps
Yeah.
saying, you need to go look this up for yourself. Don't take somebody's word for it. Don't take what you've always heard. Go look at it yourself and let me explain it to you. And that was one of them. So I thought, okay, I need to go look this up and read it in context. And the whole chapter is the context. And the whole chapter is absolutely amazing when the Spirit unpacks it. And this is right at the middle of it's a chiasm. The chapter is a chiasm. And this is right at the heart, the
Okay.
center of the chiasm. God says it twice. And right in between those two is the pinnacle of the chiasm, which is the punchline of the whole chapter. But to my absolute shock and horror,
Which chapter again?
let me look here to make sure. I'm pretty sure it was
You
Isaiah.
say I say it.
Off the top of my head, it's 26. No, it's not. Okay, now I have to look it up because.
But it's a warning not to do here a little, there a little. Is that kind of the.
Isaiah 28, I was off by two.
That's pretty good.
Okay, so right in the middle. Okay, starting with verse 9. Whom will he teach knowledge? To whom will he explain the message? Those who are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast? For it is precept on precept, precept on precept, line on line, line on line, here a little, there a little. Now, this is God talking.
There it is.
Okay. And then what does he say next? Therefore, now what he's saying is, this is what you are doing. In other words, I'm trying to teach you things. And I can't even find anybody to teach it to because this is what you're saying. This is what you are doing. This is your principles that you are relying on. And you'll see that when it's over. But he will speak to this nation with stammering lips and in another language, to whom he said, this is the resting place. This is the pinnacle of the chiasm right here. This is the resting place.
12.
Give rest to the weary. And this is the refreshing. That's the center punchline of the entire chapter. But then what? Yet they
They
would
wouldn't
not
listen.
hear.
Yeah, wouldn't listen.
Therefore, because they won't hear, why don't they hear? Because therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers that rule this people in Jerusalem, because you have no, I skipped something. Therefore, the word of the Yahweh will be to them. In other words, this is how they're hearing it. It will be to them, precept on precept, precept on precept, line on line, line on line, here a little and there a little. And
Or
what's
do
the
this and
result?
do that.
That they may go and fall backward and be broken and be snared and be taken. That is the outcome of using this method. Not a good thing.
Because whoever is identifying.
And when I first saw that, I'm like, oh God, how did we miss this all these years? Because we didn't look at it in context, which is exactly what it's talking about.
Yeah, true.
We pick and choose, including this, and applied it to fit mm-hmm. what we wanted it to say. And when I read it in context, it doesn't say that.
It's the opposite, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to say when it says here a little, there a little, do you think they were expecting trouble? Trouble upon trouble? That's one interpretation.
Okay.
That I'm seeing.
Well, it could be it could be that they're always looking for the negative.
Yeah, exactly. They're mm-hmm. expecting problems, and God's trying to bless them instead.
Yeah, the whole chapter, I did a whole sermon series on this chapter after I studied that. And the whole chapter came alive, including hell. Mm. To my amazement, the end of this chapter describes hell and the real cause for it.
Interesting.
Now, that's not to discredit the fact that we do need to compare scripture with scripture, but we don't just go through and cherry pick and ignore the context.
Mm-hmm. True.
All right.
Which is what I was raised to do.
Mm.
You know, even like half of a sentence just to prove something. So, you know, in my study now, if I go look at a verse, I immediately expand it out to several verses to get an idea of the context. And sometimes the whole chapter or more. And yes, sometimes even scripture will refer to something in the Old Testament and literally flip it on its head.
Mm.
So it will defy the original context sometimes in Revelation. And you have to expect that too, but you let it do it. And then accept, because Paul did that too. He would quote scripture and sometimes deliberately misquote it. Because he's trying to make a point in the new covenant.
Right, sorry, we are transitioning. All right, thanks for that, Floyd. Do we want to start in Revelation 1 and see how far we can get in our overview?
Sure.
What do you guys want to do?
I see Revelation 1 as I described it when I was teaching it. If you look at the whole book like a movie, which could very easily be the case, the way it's written, and the way when you sit down to watch a movie and you first start, what do you usually see at the very beginning?
Well, it's usually chronological. So you're usually introduced to the heroine or heroine.
Yes, yes. They start listing the names of the major players.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All the rest of them are listed at the other end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, while they're printing that on the screen, you're starting to get some background. And, you know, they're acting out. They're introducing you to the atmosphere, to the disposition, introducing one character at a time. And so your left brain is reading the print and your right brain's watching the pictures and listening. And mm-hmm. so they're synchronizing you. That's what chapter one is.
Yeah,
chapter one is introducing you to the hero who's introducing mm-hmm. you to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then chapters two and three are, again, running credits as to who this is written to, giving you more context, introducing you to each one. Like mm-hmm. what Bill wanted to do was let's get a flavor for the personality of each one of these seven characters.
Mm-hmm. The churches.
Mm-hmm.
Again, yeah. It's very much like in the movie. You get introduced to one after another and you really quickly like, oh, that guy's, you know, angry, or this guy is real subtle, or this guy is real shy, or, you know, this person. That's how the flow is. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're plunged into the, okay, here's the background, maybe a flashback, which I think chapter 4 is a flashback. Yes. I mean, this is how it fits for me. And if you look at chapter 4 carefully, there's no mention of the Lamb or Christ or sin. So what might that be trying to convey? At the very beginning, at the very outset, what would make sense? If you do a flashback to what was God's design before sin ever happened? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that make sense? What was the universe functioning as without sin?
Unlimited access to God's throne room and communication with all his created order.
Yeah. And continual praise, honor, synchronization, mm-hmm. not unlike the end of the book, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're being introduced right. to the original pattern, so that when all hell breaks loose, you've got this as a frame of reference.
Oh, that's a good point. I listened to, I read the book Revelation for Dummies a long time ago. And so it was actually pretty good. But one of the things they mentioned is we're often, when we go to a movie, we're used to a movie that moves chronologically, mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. to last. And he says Revelation isn't written that way, mm-hmm. in that there's all these different layers. And there was a movie, I think it's Snow on Cedars or something. When I saw it, and I can't describe the movie to you now, too long ago, but it wasn't sequential. And it had, you didn't understand it until you came to the end, because there were parts that were, you know, in the present, there were parts that were in the past. And then at the end, you saw how all of the sequencing helped you make sense of it, but it took longer than a more simple chronological readout or sequence for the movie. Mm-hmm. And that was very helpful. I go, okay. This is trying to tell a big story, but it tells it in a different kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I like how you said that the main character shows up right at the get-go, mm-hmm. a glorified Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know? And anyway, so that was helpful. And what you just said was helpful to get that.
And I believe it's also important because John is the one doing this,
mm-hmm.
John is missing Jesus because he was very, yes. very close to him personally.
Yes.
And so this same Jesus shows up, which is he's very excited about, of course, and overwhelmed because, whoa, this isn't quite the same as I remember. Mm-mm. You know, this is way bigger and more powerful, yeah. and Jesus has to like pick him up. Okay, come on, let's go. But it also ties in this book to his past. It's linking his past with the future. So this same Jesus,
yeah.
he knew on earth, mm-hmm. shows up. So for John, this is a powerful connection to his personal past. And now Jesus yeah. is saying, yes. I'm the same one. Now I'm going to show you what's future. And I yeah. want you to be the messenger to convey this to everybody else. So it's a strong link to connect the past and the future.
Yes, exactly. And he still has that connection with Jesus when, you know, he's overwhelmed and he falls down and he's mm-hmm. good as dead is one yeah. of the translations. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus puts his right hand, which is always significant, mm-hmm. on John and gives, you know, says in reassuring words, don't yield to fear. You know, so he senses that this could be overwhelming, but he's right there in the calm, assuring voice that John was used to hearing. And, you know, and extending hope in that, because he's saying, I'm the living one. I was dead, but I'm alive forever and more, you know, which was very poignant, because wasn't John, when he's writing this, the last of the disciples?
Right.
Everybody else was dead and gone. And, you know, I remember my grandmother who lived to be 97, and her husband died probably 30 years before she did. And she was one of 13, but she only had one other sibling living at the time she was living. So she says it can be really lonely when the people that you walked and shared so much of life, and they're not there. And there's other people there, but not the people who journeyed with you. So I think I like that personal emphasis about, you know, Jesus coming to John and the encouragement that he felt from that interaction with the figure that had, you know, connected all of these other relationships in his life. But, you know, he didn't have access to those relationships, but he had access to Jesus. And, you know, anyway, and what an honor, I'm sure, he to share this message.
The fact that he shows up on the Lord's Day is significant, probably for a number of reasons. If this was a labor camp, and John would have refused to work on Sabbath, which could have brought him a lot of repercussions, we don't know. But it was also the day that he contemplated and thought about Jesus and was missing him the most, because he spent the entire day thinking about him. And then Jesus shows up on the Lord's Day.
Which is significant when you think that Sabbath was intended for this communion, for this interaction between heaven and earth, between God and his creatures. And it makes sense that that would be in the context of that particular day, when God says, this is where I don't want you to be distracted, or we can just have focused time together. So that's significant to you.
And I hadn't really thought about this, but having said that, I just watched, was it this morning or last night? I watched a video somebody put together on YouTube. It was clearly probably AI generated most of the pictures, but I'm pretty sure it was a true story of an Adventist back, I don't know, quite a few years ago in Russia, who was a pastor, you know, in house churches undercover, and the authorities kept harassing him and interrogating him, and they finally threw him in a concentration camp in Siberia for 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
And when he got there and refused to work on Sabbath, they threw him in the packing crate for 10 days and let him out for 2 days of recovery. And then we worked for 2 or 3 days. And then when he refused to work on Saturday, they threw him back in the box for another 10 days. And this went on for like a year. And it was, of course, bitter cold. And they couldn't break him. And finally, a high-level colonel or somebody came to the camp for an inspection. And when he found out what they were doing to this guy, he was outraged, not because he had any sympathy, probably because he wanted more production, you know, and keeping this guy in a box for 10 days at a time is not helping. And so he ordered him taken out of the box. And he comes to the guy and he said, listen, I'll offer you a deal. I'm going to give you one of the toughest jobs in the camp, which was to take this ox and go to the spring and fill up barrels of water for the whole camp. And if you can provide enough water in 6 days, then you can have your Saturdays off. If not, you're going to be in big trouble. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, he's going to have to give it a try, right? And so he gets this ox out on Sunday, and it's an old ox, and it doesn't want to move very fast. And, you know, takes the cart down there, fills up all these barrels of water, brings it back, unloads them, has to go get and get some more. And he can barely get enough for each day. Mm-hmm. And everybody's sort of watching and scoffing. And it's like, yeah, how's your God going to handle this one, you know? And everybody knew it was impossible. And he was starting to wonder. And come Thursday night, and he's like, God, you know, please help me, because, you know, I'm going to honor your Sabbath. But, you know, he just trusted God, and he went to get the ox out the next morning, and that ox was like prancing and dancing and took off on a run. And he could barely keep up. And he went back and forth all day long. The ox never got tired, didn't want to stop for anything. And he had so much water by the end of Friday. And the camp guards and everybody were going like, what in the world is going on here? And they said, well, I guess you met the deal. I guess you can have Sabbath off. And for the next 9 years, that ox was doing that. And on Sabbath, they went out there and tried to get the ox to work. And he just stand there and look at him, wouldn't take a step. Nothing. They beat him. They yelled at him. They yanked on him. He wouldn't budge. Every other day, slow as molasses. On Friday, tearing up and down. Every single week. So when they handed over the job to another prisoner, he couldn't get the ox to work on Sabbath either. when they released him from the camp, the ox still would not work on Sabbath. And the camp commander's like, oh, great. He's converted the ox to be a Sabbath keeper too.
Oh, that's funny.
So, you know, it reminded me of that when I read, you know, John is on this labor camp island and he refuses to work on Sabbath. So who knows what happened? And yet God shows up on Sabbath.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Because, of course, in Deuteronomy 5, I knew it's not in Exodus, but it's in Deuteronomy 5. They specify, you know, who's not to work. And it's not only yourself and your children, but male slaves, female slaves, your ox, your donkey, any of your livestock. But the first animal mentioned is the ox. And I think I saw, when we were scanning through trying to study Revelation, the ox that would not work, I saw something.
That's
a little
it.
Clip, the ox that would not work. So I got, I wonder if that's what Floyd is just describing there.
That is. So,
that's pretty cool. God's going to get his message across in all kinds of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a great connection. Yes, but how meaningful to John. Meaningful to John. Okay, well, you're doing good, Floyd. Just keep going. Where are we now? Are we up to chapter? We're about to the churches.
Chapters 2 and 3. Okay. This whole movie is about a war, right?
Right.
Yes.
Very clearly. I mean, the center of the chiasm is there's war in heaven.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the entire thing is about a war, and you're getting the inside scoop on this war from the winners. From the one who wins overall.
Right.
So you're getting the right perspective on the whole thing. So before you go into war, the general reviews the troops.
Oh,
yeah. Chapter 2 and 3 is reviewing the troops.
Oh, that's
and
a cool
review
idea.
It's not just a formality. He's actually examining and probing into the strengths and weaknesses of each one of these, whatever you want to, battalions or whatever you want to call them. The churches are made up of people and they have their unique weaknesses and strengths. And that's what he's addressing. Mm-hmm. This is the condition of his army.
And all the solutions to their strengths and insufficiency is found in their commander. He has the solution to each of their problems, right?
Right.
And who he is. Yes.
Now that Bill suggested doing this, and I really like this idea, the more I think about it, because if you, the reason he's pointing out their strengths and weaknesses is for what's coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the rest of the book.
Right.
So if we can tie together those strength and weakness analysis of each one and say, okay, why would he point this out based on what's going to happen over here? And start linking those. And I love that idea. I haven't even started doing it, but I'm probably going to go in there and start hyperlinking that too. Because there are so many webs, layers of patterns in this book. Just layer upon layer upon layer. And then there's threads, single threads, like phrases and words that are woven all the way through the book, and they emerge and they disappear and they emerge and they disappear. And when you trace that thread through, you, in the context of each place it shows up, it has its own story. Mm-hmm. So you got the interleaving stories and then overlapping patterns. And then cycles. There's a lot of cycles in Revelation. Of course, 7 shows up all over the place. And Tonstadt was very helpful. Years ago, I listened to a bunch of his, and he gave me some very good tools that helped unravel a lot of this stuff. And one of them that I don't know how he explained it, but for me, visually, which for me, I have to sometimes think visually, sometimes I can't, but the 3 sevens, the 3 or 4 sevens, I think there's 3 major ones. You got the 7 seals, the 7 trumpets, and the 7 bowls.
Mm-hmm.
The other sevens don't, the 7 thunders, you don't get anything on. And there's actually 7 angels, believe it or not.
Right.
Because we got 1, 2, 3 counted, and then you have another, but there's some other anothers in there that we overlooked, and there's actually ends up 7.
Yes, exactly.
But the primary, the 3 sets of 7, and Tonstadt was saying they are sequential, but, you know, but it backs up and you know, it's like you move forward, but then you back up and start with a different thing. So it's sort of like, okay, let's look at the story through the eyes of, say, economics. I'm not saying that's here, but just as illustration. Okay, so we've explained how the story progresses from that perspective. Now let's go back and look at it based on, say, social emotions. So then you go through it that, and then you back them and say, well, what if we looked at it from a legal, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they're all overlapping, but they're not necessarily completely parallel. And I sort of wrestled with that for quite a while until it began emerging. It was, to me, it's like wheels and spokes. So there's 7 spoked wheels. Each wheel has 7 spokes. And you got 3 wheels. So if you're thinking of them rolling across the ground and you're looking at the ground, which is sequential, whereas where they touch the ground, when each spoke comes down and touches the ground, those are sequential. But they don't all happen parallel to each other because the wheels are not the same diameter. So a great big wheel rolling one cycle is going to cover a whole lot more ground than a little wheel turning one cycle, right? Which is why they don't always synchronize, and yet there's similarities, and yet there's not, and you're going, okay, how does this fit? And so I kept looking for clues and patterns, and I finally decided, I could be corrected often, but it seemed like the wheels always end up at the same place. But if they're different sized wheels, that means they don't begin at the same place. But they do end up at the same place at the same time.
Right. Because each of those sequences ends in the day of the Lord, you know, right? So Jesus comes, and so even though they are different, they have the same ending. So it makes sense they come to the same place. And I know Bible Project talks about them kind of be like nesting dolls, you know, those Russian nesting dolls that this one, you know, because the seals, you know, the trumpets are in the seals, and then the bowls are in the come out of the trumpets. And that was their point. They're different, but they make a point in a different way. And when we were reviewing Bible Project, they did talk about how if you look at the floodwaters play a significant, you know, part in creation, God's spirit was hovering over the deep. And often these vile creatures, you know, are coming up out of the ocean. So they talked about that, and they talked about the plagues more not in the seals, but more in the trumpets. And then I can't remember what the other one was. It was different ways of looking at it, but it was trying to say they're telling the same story, but they're using different connections, you know, and all these different layers to try to help us see the bigger picture, you know, in a different way. They're different ways, but want us to end up with similar conclusions, that they're all telling, they're different stories, but they're all telling a part of that story.
Yes. They're contributing it from different directions.
Right.
So you're getting a more holistic.
Yes. And so it made sense with the way movies are constructed instead of chronologically. This is a story, and at first it seems disconnected, but you don't, then you understand how that seemingly disconnected story impacts all of the major players. And it makes sense in its, when you come to the end.
Yeah. And God wins.
I didn't say that very well, but I think that's what you're saying. Okay, keep going, Flora. I like it. And I don't know how much time you want to do. It's almost 5. So, but I like what you're saying. That makes sense to me. And it's a bigger overview.
In another sense, I also see the 3 sets of 7 as sequential, which sounds like I'm contradicting, which does sound contradictory. And yet I see that as well. Because the seals being broken, you don't notice too much number symbology in there. When you get to the trumpets, all of a sudden you have a whole bunch of, what is it, thirds? Mm-hmm. Which is significant in itself, as you know.
Yes, one third and a third.
And then when you get to the bowls, it's all out. And it repeats some of the same things that were in the trumpets, but now it's not just thirds and fourths, it's like all. That's a pattern of sequence. Also, I've noticed another pattern that emerges all through the book, and I'm sure it actually applies many more times than I've seen. But I began realizing, even in the studies we've done here, it started emerging that the book will do a summary of what's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there'll be a real concise summary, like one or two verses will be a condensation. Mm-hmm. And then the next, say, chapter or half a chapter will unpack it halfway. And then the next two chapters are going to unpack it even more, which gets confusing because you think if you're trying to read it sequentially, I'm like, what? But if you say, no, this is summarizing, it's sort of like a sermon, right? Tell them what you're going to say and then say it and then tell them what you said. Well, in this case, it's tell them what you're going to say and then unpack it about halfway and then go back and start over and unpack it a whole bunch more. And that actually explains a lot of stuff, a lot of the sequential stuff that's like, okay, actually that works better. For instance, chapter four, which is the beginning of the vision, the beginning of the real part of the movie, like I said, I think it says, okay, this was the ideal. This is how God created the universe to function. And then chapter five is really a synopsis of the rest of the book. Because now you're introduced to the Lamb. Now you're introduced. There's a problem. There weren't any problems in chapter four. There's a serious problem. Exactly. The one on the throne is stuck holding the bag and can't do anything about it, which is like, what do you mean he can't do anything about it? He's all powerful. He can do anything. No, he can't. He can't even open the scroll. So you got to figure out, okay, what is this about? Why is John freaked out about it? Why is a slaughtered lamb the solution to it? And that is, it's generating questions, which says it's introducing the problem and the solution and the praise. So, and then the praise is exponentially more intense than it was in chapter four. So you got a progression from just normal praise to like exponential praise. Because of the Lamb. So that becomes the foundation for the rest of the book.
Yeah. So how he reveals, how he saves, how he, you know, ultimately rules. Yes, that I'm not saying that very well, but, you know, he's slain. So there's a clue. You know, lamb of lamb, everybody knew what the lamb symbolized, but a slain lamb having, you know, especially when they talk about, you know, the lion from the tribe of Judah, that sounds a lot more impressive than a lamb that has neck blood gushing out of his neck.
It's way worse than that. Way worse than that. Because that's another thing Tonstadt pointed out, that in the Greek, this is a violently slaughtered lamb, not just a sacrificed lamb. And that's key.
Yes. Yeah, he uses the word violent.
Yes.
Numerous times.
Which is what the whole book is about.
Yeah.
It's God who refuses to participate in violence versus the dragon who only uses violence.
Yes.
And deception.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
And so now it starts shaping up that this war is not about who's strongest. The war is about how do you fight war?
Yeah, right.
Whose methods do you use? What motives do you have, which is extremely important? And what are the messages that correspond to the methods and motives? And that template is applied to every place you go in Revelation. And once you use that template, the template of the Lamb, his methods, his motives, and his words, and then you use that to interpret everything you read after that.
Yes, right. If you don't get that, you're going to end up with a God that uses violence, which is how most people see God as retributive, you know, violent, you know, even Jesus coming, you know, he's going to take a sword and, you know, destroy people and use violence, even though he never has before. Yeah, so that makes sense. so important to get that, because otherwise you're going to misinterpret how God operates.
Well, two thoughts come to the upside down kingdom of Jesus. It's not all what you'd expect. You don't ever win a war by losing your life.
Right.
The lesson, you're Jesus, you know. And then the other thought is, it's not at all what we'd expect. Very nature is survival of the fittest.
Right.
So we don't even comprehend the way you would fight a war the way God is. It just doesn't. It can't be a war if you're not fighting, can it?
See, it challenges us to redefine every word.
Yeah. Bible Project uses that over the upside down kingdom, because it's not how we as humans go about. This isn't the story we'd go, no, the hero doesn't die. I don't like movies where the hero dies. It's no. The hero may kill other people, but the hero doesn't die, you know, anyway. And yet in our story, hero died.
Unless you can kill death.
Yes.
But see, the hero dies for greater
death.
For a greater cause. It's kind of like Superman and Kryptonite. He doesn't really die.
Right.
You know, he dies to himself and all the evilness of what has infected humanity, but he doesn't die as we think of death.
Well,
I just think it's so important to understand this so we can, you know, be equipped for some staggering, you know, as the man of sin is revealed and uses lying signs and wonders, you know, we can't be fooled by a great show. You have to know it has to be about character, and it ultimately has to be about the methods used, because so many people are just open to a God who's okay with murdering and destroying and killing. And that's what I've appreciated about Siegfried Tonstenz. He says, this is not a God who uses violence. He is responding to Satan, who wields the power of death, and he is, by doing what he does, able to destroy death. As Jesus says, I hold the keys. You know, I'm the one who was dead, but I'm alive forevermore. So he conquered death and destroyed death. But he doesn't use that. He doesn't use those things. He's here to say, there's an end to this. And yet so much of the evangelical world is just ready to embrace, you know, a God who is, you know, like when you read parts of the Left Behind series, which I couldn't read, but, you know, he just describes God in horrific, horrible ways in how he destroys the sinners. I could hardly read it. It was kind of like Jonathan Edwards' sermons. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. And you go, this is satanic. There's no other descriptor. But we have, unfortunately, you know, distorted views of who God is. And that's why it's so important for me to, because there's some confusing symbols in Revelation that can be misinterpreted as this is a God who uses violence instead of the God who allows himself to experience violence so he can defeat violence.
So the lamb does die, but he doesn't disappear.
Right.
Because in dying, he destroys death itself, which is totally unexpected. It's like, wait,
how
our
do you
movies
do that?
Can't do that because our heroes, when they died, they're gone. But in the cosmic power, he dies, but because he is life, he destroys the very power of death itself. And comes out with the keys, which is actually counterfeited by paganism, because Marduk, I think it was Marduk, fights the god Mot, which is the god of the ground, and it opens its mouth every once in a while to swallow people to feed itself. And Mott and Marduk get into it, and Marduk gets caught in Mott's mouth and gets buried for 3 days.
Yeah.
Interestingly. Long before Jesus ever showed up.
Yeah.
But he ends up coming out and defeating Mott.
Mm-hmm.
How subtle, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he defeats him through violence.
Yes, he defeats
him
through violence.
Doesn't he?
That's right. That's the key difference.
He kills him, right? All the pagan gods are always, you know, killing each other. Or when you studied the Caesars, you know, they're killing their mothers, their fathers, their wives, their children, you know, any opponent. But it's just awful. All in the name of power grabbing. I don't care who I take out. Yes. So that, anyway, but that, you're right. There's distortions through paganism. And unfortunately, we have pagan Christianity, which also portrays God. Right. God destroys.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that's all what's in the scroll. Actually, what's on the outside of the scroll, because it says the scroll is written on the inside and the outside.
Mm-hmm.
If the scroll cannot be opened, all you can see is what's on the outside, which is graffiti. Yeah. It's the accusations against God.
Mm-hmm.
The truth about God is inside the scroll, and it's been locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think would lock the truth?
Well, part of me wants to say lies. Satan is the liar and the deceiver.
Exactly.
But isn't things being hidden until they're opened up, which is interesting. There's lots of doors in heaven, open doors,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and he's the one who can open doors and nobody can shut them and nobody can open them. So until he opens our ability to see how he truly operates, we're going to be locked out of the truth about who he is.
But chapter 5 makes it very clear that God is the one on trial.
Mm.
And he's the one stuck with this scroll that would vindicate him, but you can't vindicate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he can't open it.
Yes.
The very principle involved says, I can't prove myself right. And somebody else has to be found to do that for him. And the only way they can do that for him is by getting access to the scroll, which means you have to get past the seals. So the lies, the number 7 is perfect. So it's a perfect system of lies that locks the scroll shut. And nobody in the universe can be found who can crack this code. And it looks like God's over a barrel forever. In fact, I believe that was the condition of the universe just before this world was created.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Lamb who started cracking the scrolls open.
Mm-hmm. And creation.
Yes. And through all of history. So now the Lamb has 7 horns. How convenient. There's 7 seals.
Mm-hmm.
So if he breaks the seals, he's got 1 horn specifically designed for each seal.
I never thought about that. I don't know if I've heard the significance. I mean, I know horns are to indicate power that kings or kingdoms would utilize. But I think Jennings talks about that, about how God utilizes, you know, and one was creation. And anyway, he talks about some ideas that those horns might be representative of. But I love how you said he's unlocking the seals, and he does that through his horns. How else would he do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
No hands, no fingers. Anyway, just with the symbolism.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Ironically, it just makes sense to me that if it's important, the scroll gets opened. That means there's truth inside that would get God off the hook.
Yeah.
If there's the only thing that's going to block you access to the truth are lies. Therefore, my conclusion has to be these seals represent lies. So whatever is released when you break the seal is going to be a lie.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you think of one of those first seal with the four horsemen coming out and how telling, because most people, as you said, they're angry at God. Some of the people in your life are angry at God because my son died or my son's ill or this terrible, awful thing happened. And so whether that's, you know, death or war or terrible things that happen to people, as Bible Project said, you know, you have peace that's taken from the earth, and then you have war, then you have famine and pestilence, and you have death, you know. And he says, unfortunately, an average day, you know, in life here on planet Earth, he's just describing. And yet so many people hold God responsible for all those terrible, awful things. But, you know, when we understand the writers, we understand that the one that was given a crown and, you know, given a bow, yeah, that's Satan, and this is his entourage, and that's how he rules, and what his kingdom is like. These are the tools that he utilizes. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, but the scripture points out the whole world is under the control of the evil one.
Mm-hmm.
But most people think God is the one in charge.
Right.
And they don't even read the Bible, so they give God credit for something the devil really has done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's the devil's plan.
Yeah, because they say God is sovereign. And I go, well, there's truth to that, and there's misunderstandings that can flow out of that. Mm-hmm. God is not responsible for everything that happens. People do what people do. Satan does what Satan does. You know, so you can distort sovereignty to make God ultimately responsible for everything, everything good and everything bad.
And recently I was watching the end of a series by Darius Yankovich, which is extremely good. You'd probably like the whole series, but the end of it, the last three were on the investigative judgment.
Mm.
He did a really good job of unpacking perspective on it. And one of the things he explained is there are two kinds of religion. One is monogistic and the other one is synergistic. And monogistic religion, which is most of evangelicals, in short, despite what they say, they do not believe in free will. It's determinism. And
yes.
So you might have an aha moment when you suddenly realize that you're saved. But there's once you're saved, that's it. Because it's all done at the cross. There's nothing, you know, you can't contribute anything. And the language sounds very compelling. But there's no free will. In fact, I've had people surprised when I talk about free will. Free will is a very untouched topic, and I'm seeing why now. Because free will is too risky. But then that's why the war started, because Satan said it's too risky.
Right.
And God's banking the whole universe on saying, yeah, it's too risky, and I'm going to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of people are going to get hurt in the process. And God's going to get hurt the most.
But otherwise, you don't have.
That's right.
There's no love. If
love
there's
and
no
freedom.
That's right.
You don't.
2 Corinthians 3:17. The Lord is spirit. Where the spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom.
Yes.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And synergistic says, and he said, there's all different kinds of synergistic, and they're not all correct either. But synergistic approach says, you cooperate with God. You work with God using your free will. And it's not an all or nothing. Now, one extreme of that is just straight up legalism. You know, you do it all, get it right. And then there's a sliding scale of, okay, well, God does 50% and I do my part and all that stuff. But to monogistic theologians, that whole thing is heresy. It's all heresy. Because you shouldn't be doing anything. You're taking away from the perfect atonement of Jesus Christ. But you know what? They almost all have one common denominator, that God has to be paid off.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very helpful to see the difference and to realize that free will is at the heart of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom of choice. And I've had discussions even the last day or two with people who are really confused on this thing, and they think, oh, well, but when Jesus comes, this will all be over. And I said, don't you realize that you're going to have the freedom to walk away from God for all eternity?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they haven't thought about that. That's almost scary.
Mm-hmm.
I see the progression of the seven seals, particularly the four horsemen, as very intentional. And the lamb starts with the most difficult lie to deal with. He doesn't work up to it. He starts with the knockout punch at the beginning, which is that Jesus is just like Satan. And even Adventist theologians.
Oh, yes.
You know, for a long time, it's like, oh, this is Jesus and that's not Jesus. And this. I'm like, how do you get to pick and choose?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's clear indicators here. There's a problem with this, but it's the most difficult one. And so that's the first one he takes out. Then you work progressively through to the obvious ones, you know, violence and death and all that stuff. But he takes out the most difficult one first.
Which is, he's evidenced. You see more of what he is like when you see who he's riding with. He's his, you know, his troop, his cavalry, who's riding along with him. Interestingly, I listened to a fascinating interview on AI and some of the brilliant minds that are behind this, which also worship Satan. Mm. And one of their teachings is Satan and Jesus are the same. They're, you know, and it was just, anyway, I won't get into it, but it was stunning, terrifying, scary. That a lot of this amazing stuff coming through is directly related to people who channel and says, yeah, I didn't write any of this. It was just written through me and I'm accessing beings where I, demons, and I'm okay with that as long as they get me where I want to with this advanced information and technology, and they're okay with death. So I watched a congressional hearing on the negative impact of AI in particularly on young adults, children, teenagers, where parents are testifying that they had three parents and two of the children had suicide at the instruction and encouragement of AI, their AI interactions, and they had the chats, and it was just horrifying. And yet the response of the builders of the AI, you know, they were supposed to do safety testing for 4 weeks. Well, they did one, and they're willing to compensate people $100. Anyway, it was just horrendous. And I go, this shows you when you don't value life and you're okay with the consequence of innocent lives dying and being taken out. But if you can advance, if you can get to the front of the pack, if you can make a bunch of money, well, we know there's going to be some collateral damage. Oh, well. Anyway, it was just amazing. But again, it was, you go, where is this? I don't want to dominate, but it was fascinating to say what methods are being used, what principles, how can you distinguish between good and evil? And it related to how what's the operating basis? What's the value of life or the discounting of life? Anyway, side note, but it's kind of related to what you're, the Four Horsemen for sure.
Oh, it's related to the whole book. In fact, I'm still convinced, and I have been for several years, that the image of the beast is AI. And there's no way anybody could have predicted that because we'd never heard of AI before. And now it's a major player in the whole world and fast taking over. And they, you know, they're already in the process probably of handing over the justice system to AI because it's highly efficient. It can enforce the rules. It knows exactly what the rules are. And it can look at all the evidence and assess it, and we could streamline justice. Just let AI do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is very interesting, you know, who's being worshiped, you know, again, as you said, we can look through these things from an economic viewpoint. Well, man, that's for sure in Revelation, the economic impact and the wielding of that to coerce and have power over. So you could see how that definitely, I used to insist on going to the people at like Costco that were there to scan your stuff instead of doing it myself. I go, we're just getting, these people are going to lose their jobs. Anyway, I don't have you do this and me, but anyway, so, hey, well, more closing thoughts, Floyd, I want to be time sensitive to everybody. I've loved this. This has been good job, Floyd.
Yeah.
One of the other patterns that I see throughout the book is like waves. So you got peaks and troughs. And it's very helpful because the peaks are where you get the revelation of life and love and light and truth and all that stuff. And then you plunge into a trough. And you're going, man, this is really depressing. And then all of a sudden, here comes a chapter that puts you back on the top of the peak and you get a gasp of air and light and, you know, take a big gasp of air because you're going back into the next one. By the time you get into some of the trumpets, you're going, I don't know if I can handle much more of this negativity. And then all of a sudden, here comes a spike and it just goes like that. Until finally you come out the other end and it ends on a plateau of high.
Yeah. So it ends. Yeah. I mean, it starts in a beautiful way with Jesus showing up. And then, of course, Revelation 20 and 21 ends in this restoration and how actually the death of the world gives life to this new world where there is no more death, no more dying, no more pain, no more sorrow. You know, so it starts and ends with those, like you said, those highs, the fact that God ultimately wins.
And the corresponding to 21 and 22 is chapters 4 and 5, because that's the actual vision. So you got a lot of praise.
Throne room.
And then 5 is starting to go in for the negative. And then if you're coming from the other end, 22 is all, you know, praise and goodness. In 21, you're just coming out of the valley. So they correspond to each other. They mirror each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, a good point. Well, thanks for pointing that out. Well, this has been awesome, you guys. We got through chapter, 4 and into 5. Starting to talk about 5, right?
4 and 5, we did. 6 is the seals.
Yeah, so, we started talking about those. Yeah, but I appreciate the focus on God doesn't vindicate himself. Jesus shows up and shows the contrast between who he is and how he rules versus how Satan is and how he rules. One bringing life, the other bringing destruction, power, force, coercion, and a pretty dismal outcome.
And those are the anchors or the superstructure that everything has to hang on in the whole book. Otherwise, the stuff is just confusing and it doesn't make sense and you don't have any reference points. But when you have the big picture, which it starts with a big picture.
Yes.
And then the rest of the time you say, okay, where does this fit back into the big picture? What do I hook this on? Is this defining the lamb or is this the dragon? Mm-hmm. And when you have that objective view as you go through the whole book, instead of just trying to plow into it and try to figure this out on my own, no, look at the big picture. Keep referencing outside of what you're reading right here. Then you can see the forest for the, you know, you can actually see the forest from up above instead of wandering through the forest trying to figure out what is this all about kind of thing.
Exactly.
Right. I like your thought. For me, it comes like this. If I forget to look at chapter 12, I don't know the context into which I'm born. I'm born into a world at war, a universe at war. Battles over my heart. And Satan is trying to compete with God for my attention.
Well, and your identity. I like, you know, because it is the identity, who we are, that our identity has been stolen and by Satan. And he wants to tell us a different story about God, which ultimately affects the story about us. And he wants to, so Jesus gives us that the story correctly, what his intentions are, what he wants. And, you know, Revelation 20:21 is how he deals with this conflict by giving each person what they ultimately wanted. That's what they ultimately want. So, well, this has been awesome. Thank you, Floyd. Good job leading it. I don't know if you knew you were going to do that today, but good job.
I'm glad you were on it.
Exactly.
So next week, are we going to do Ephesus?
Whatever we decide to do next week. I don't think we're in a tearing hurry.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know.
Yeah. I mean,
I got to do Laodicea next week.
Well, and I don't mind doing a little bit more overview. That's very helpful because we've gone up to about, you know, started to talk about some in chapter 5? Or is that chapter 6?
Six.
So anyway, that's helpful because, like I said, I'm so used to focus on some of the details that sometimes I don't know how those details anchor to the story. And that's where, you know, I need to look at the story through the Great Controversy lens, through the conflict with Satan trying to trounce God's character and how God responds.
Not Great Controversy, cosmic view.
Yeah, the cosmic perspective. Well, Great Controversy fits too. I'm an Adventist, so.
I can also send you all the charts and graphs and stuff because there's chiastic structures in there that are very helpful for like getting an overview.
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks, Floyd. They're coming through perfect.
Thank you. I'm going to have some work cut out for me, Floyd. So thank you.
I'll go in and make copies of all those cross references and put it into a document and send those to you so you can at least read them. And then you'll have all the texts that go with each verse.
Okay, plus that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay.
That's going to be very helpful. All right. Does someone want to close in prayer? Peggy, you don't want to close in prayer for us?
Sure. Well, dear Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for this time together to study your word, to share what it is that you would have for us to know about you and the universe and your plan for ending sin. Guide us throughout this week. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.